Hello, back in the States.
Welcome to America again.
Yes.
How does this feel? It's so I it's so it's it happened so quickly. It was like 4 days. We did two episodes here in 4 days,
Yeah.
and then you just flew right
Flew
back.
back.
You
Yeah.
had to
The
get more of
world
that
feels.
anti-Semitic pressure. You couldn't deal without it, right?
No, the world feels way smaller. I never did a trip so fast like that. But you feel way closer. I didn't realize how easy it is to just to hop across the ocean. A lot of pressure over here, Leo. Still a lot of pressure over here.
I'm curious, did you feel, where did it feel, where did you feel more comfortable, here where you are right now or here? Because I know how it is to leave a home. I know it's tough for me, come, when I came back
Comfortable
here.
anti-Semitism wise?
No, just Jewish wise, just as a Jew, right? Not necessarily only anti-Semitism, but
No, I couldn't say in this sense I felt such difference. There's no shortage of problems in Israel either, by the way.
no, we're producing them at a very rapid rate. So
I'm glad that we have an army here. I'm not sure what could happen. But no, I couldn't say that one place feels more calm and
basically,
serene than another.
there's nowhere to hide, basically, is what I'm
There's
trying to get
nowhere
you to
to
say.
hide.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
That's got that
it's
sound bite.
yeah.
So this whole anti-Semitism thing has been on our mind, and I know we've done like a really massive kind of really macro view of history, and also looked at some things. But today I have someone who's we have a really great guest here on the Jew Function Talks. He's someone who actually, you know him from, some past life, let's call it. And I also talked to him before, tried to get him to get the person he's working for to come talk to us on in one of the Honest Conversation episodes. If you haven't seen it, by the way, check it out. Those are really some powerful talks there with different people, Jews, anti-Semites,
That's
talk
on our
to.
YouTube playlist.
It's on our YouTube playlist. Yeah, it's interesting people talking to Dr. Lightman, who's a bio-cyberneticist and a Kabbalist and just a great thinker all around. And those are really interesting conversations. But we finally got an opportunity, an excuse to talk to him firsthand because he just recently published a book on anti-Semitism.
There are about a billion people worldwide that harbor anti-Jewish sentiments.
It's these like moments where we get to the edge as a people. That we're gonna renew who we are.
Us Jews are not creating that healthy environment.
Our premise is let's not wait until we almost die again.
He's the assistant of Dov Hykind.
Like, good Lord, man, does it ever end?
But he's also the executive director of Americans Against Anti-Semitism.
You know, I think we've been pretty nasty to the Jews for 2,000 years. We should probably like lighten up.
And he just published this book, A Brief and Visual History of Anti-Semitism.
The flip side of all those dark chapters is that we persisted.
Yisrael Biton, please join us.
The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?
Hello, hello. Thank you
Amen.
for having
Hi.
me. Good to
Welcome
see
to
you.
the yeah, welcome to the Jew Function.
Good to finally be here.
It's true. It felt like, we talked over the years a few times, and I was like, he's a good guy. We're gonna talk to him somehow. I have a feeling.
The seeds were planted, and God's in charge of the timing, and at the right time, and this is it. So I'm certainly happy to have the opportunity not only to discuss anti-Semitism, but your particular approach, which I think is important and certainly relates to to the book. So.
Nice. And you just kind of said it, in passing, that God's in charge of the time, but I think he's in charge of more than just that, right? He's probably.
Well, it's more than just in charge. We want to jump right into it. God, the
Oh,
entire universe is God, so there is no, God and enod. There's nothing else. But in context of our phenomenological experience of, self agency, then there's what we our part, and there's the part that we know for sure is beyond our direct control. That, we say is okay. There's, you can't say, well, it's God until God pushes me to do something, then obviously God didn't want me to do it. So, you know, there's that duality, obviously.
Right.
You can go endlessly into how much is the agency.
After everything the Jews have been through, there's kind of two camps. One camp is like, after everything we've been through, how could I believe in God? And the other one's like, and after everything we've been through, how could I not believe in God?
Absolutely. But, you know, they're both valid.
Right, they're both valid. But what's your research and experience? What has that yielded on that? Is there something that we're doing or not doing as Jews unto God? You know, the whole chosen people thing. How does that work?
That you mean doing that contributes in a way to anti-Semitism? Is that what you're saying?
Well, either that or just in general, like, you know, we can take a step back even. It's okay. We'll have the whole hour to talk about anti-Semitism. We could just talk in general. Like what, okay, I'll phrase it this way. There's all been all these films that have come out over the years is like, you know, what women want, right? Like nobody knows. But the question is, what are Jews? You know, what does God want of Jews? What is your feeling about it?
I think it's actually pretty simple, and I think it is all related. And in going through the history of anti-Semitism, so you're dealing with communal and intra-communal dynamics, it does go back as far as I'm concerned. The one thread, and what I kind of say at the end, what can be done? Like, what's the message ultimately? And the thing comes up, is it anti-Semitism? Is it not? Is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? It's like all obfuscation, because the reality is this, the essence of the Torah, the one thing that, you know, is supposed to sustain us and really create a healthy, positive cycle in all interactions, is the golden rule. You know, treat others the way you want to be treated. It's that simple. And it makes perfect sense. There's nothing more logical than to suggest that you have no right to expect of any other living being what you yourself would not afford them. But what we have in practice from, you know, the moment Adam and Eve, made their mistake and set us on this course, there's been this issue of the golden rule, and you have this disparity. So you have people like you had Cain kill Hevel, whereas, you know, there's a certain audacity that says, wait a second, you were just put out on this level playing field, and one person decided that they're entitled to take someone else's life. And as, you know, Rashi talks about there, that he was also guilty of killing descendants. Like that's there. Right. It's not something that, well, you killed the life. Okay. It's, you know, well, one person. So to me, what I see is that the extent to which, you know, Jews have to do what Jews have to do, irrespective of, it contributes to anti-Semitism. Its purpose, it was there to wait.
So like, hold on, say the same thing, but say it in total simple language. Instead of Jews have to do what Jews have to do, what do Jews have to do?
So that in terms of the golden rule, right? The golden rule, where does it start breaking down? It starts breaking down in a society where you're like, okay, I'm listening to the laws. I follow the rules and I'm good to my neighbor, but my neighbor is being selfish. Well, okay. It starts to create a little bit of an imbalance. And if it's not corrected, well, you start to have all these issues in society, haves, have-nots, envy, jealousy, a warped competition that devolves into, you know, violence. And that's why we have people getting belted in the face in New York, because they're guilty of past crimes, they're guilty of present crimes, of future crimes, they're just perpetually guilty. But of course, that's a warping. When you say treat others the way you want to be treated, nobody would want to walk down the street and say, oh, I understand that some people have grievances and they're real, you know, socioeconomic, maybe their brother was killed by the IDF, so I would understand. And therefore what? Therefore, it's a corruption of the golden rule to suggest that entitles that one person to go and take, you know, revenge on a random person. So that is essentially a warping of the golden rule. It's not much else than that. It starts with that and that relates to both the Jewish and non-Jewish world. And that's what I mean, that we have to do what we have to do, in the sense that the lesson going back more than 2,000 years, you know, whether it was Hillel, whether it was Rabbi Akiva, who made the point that everything else is commentary, everything else is tavlin, it's a spice, thank you, it's nice. But the main thing is if two people can't get along, can understand that it doesn't matter what nature may have endowed you with. You may be stronger, bigger, smarter, richer, whatever it is. In terms of treating the other individual, treating the other as you would want to be treated is to say, oh, if I wasn't strong, how would I want to be treated? I would want to be treated with a little more, go easy, don't threaten the person. So it's not only understanding it from your current vantage point of like, how would I, you know, if I inserted myself in someone else's position, maybe, which people, it's a difficult exercise because you end up really just thinking about yourself, and people have difficulty escaping themselves in a pure empathy where you really think about that person's existence. You know, I think about often some people end up committing crimes. What is it? How does it devolve to that? And if you look back often there, I mean, people who, it's not that you have people who, didn't come from loving families, good parents, and end up becoming a serial killer or something. But we're talking about where there's a breakdown in a person. And it's not, I'm not talking about someone who's psychopathic or sociopathic and has those type of tendencies. But really, it's knowing that you as an individual, it starts with this, the golden rule. You're not immune from anything, neither from being so great or so warped and so bad. And every individual has to, like, when I look at, you know, the bad people of the world, I don't go, oh my gosh, those people, how did they get there? I go, oh gosh, I got to be careful because anybody could get there. Anybody can devolve. So there are many ways to, you know, put that exercise into practice. And it needs to be done internally, externally. We need to hold people to that, standard, but we have to hold ourselves to that standard as well. Now, one shouldn't come at a cost of the other, say, well, until the Jews do, and the fact that the Jews have infighting, one doesn't excuse the other. But if we're going to be real, we know that we've been struggling for 2,000 years to try to get that right.
But this is exactly, you just ended up on the point that we're always trying to look at. And you know, we'll for the listeners, we'll go back, you know, in a second to, you know, we'll rewind a little bit. But I feel this is a great point because we always talk about, all right, some people say we're all human. We all have to, you know, start acting according to this golden rule, as you said. And we all have to start, holding ourselves accountable for what's happening around us and so on and so forth. And it's our job to, you know, point out the, you know, the ones who are not doing it and also try to improve ourselves, sort of like this democratic process of self-improvement, so to speak. What we're saying and what the way systems are built in nature and the way history kind of shows us, and especially the way a lot of Jewish texts shows it, and of course you can always find a counter text to every text, but for the most part what we saw is that somehow those called Jews have to do it first, have to sort of lead the way, show the way, that it can't happen unless they do it too.
Do what first? Love your neighbor as yourself?
Start showing that application of the rule in practice, not say it here and then do the opposite there. Not, we're a small group. We're not like billions of people. We can say, well, what do I know? No, we're a small group. Our numbers haven't changed in over 2,000 years. It's almost always been the same number. It's a few million people. So we are always having these connections. Just before we talked, you guys realized you know each other. I realized I knew Seth even before I met him. I knew him through another, a friend of a friend. Now, like, what are the chances of that? I was born in Israel. He was born in New Jersey. You know, we have nothing to do with each other. Somehow we're two people removed, right?
Should be easy
to somehow say, let's do this. So the question is, why aren't we doing this? Or what's stopping us from doing it first? And it's much easier to say, you guys need to do it, but the last thing a person wants to do is change himself, right? I'll change the world, but not myself. So why is it so difficult, do you think?
I think you touched on two important, points to respond to. And one is like kind of going back to the origins and why it seems that, you know, the Jews must accomplish this first, that it's on us, as it were. More in the present context in terms of, how that gets translated. Going back, I think it's important to realizes the point I've been making as well, because it's not just in terms of Judaism and how we see, you know, philosophically, theologically, this point, but anti-Semitism itself is very much driven by, well, the consequences of how Judaism emerged, and more importantly, the fact that two offshoot religions emerged from Judaism that I think many Jews don't necessarily realize, and a lot of people in the world don't realize, that it's entirely unique in the way religions formed, developed, and went about in a number of important ways. Human nature in thousands of years, I hate to say, we all like new age, modern, oh, social media, it's changing. Human nature, the core of human nature, for as far back as, you know, there are humans that they can find and discover and study, it's the same core, the same lashon hara, the same way of talking about people that leads to things, the same envy, jealousy, the same disparities.
Well, we just got worse. You could say we changed. We got worse. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but there's
more clever about it.
We're constantly progressing. That history is you know, it's teleological. It's moving towards this, and it can be, but it's not happening automatically. And the one difference, we don't need to change our nature to some, you know, we're all going to become saints and angels. That's not the point. The point is not to become great. It's to become good and decent, which means treating others the way you want to be treated. Nothing more. Don't be exceptional. Go out of your way to be a floor mat for people. That's not what is being asked. It's a simple, you know, equality. And that keeps a healthy cycle. The moment that one side is out, the yin yang, if you will, you know, it's the same concept. It's universal. Then we get this issue of, you know, and then think of it as a mathematical equation. If we think of two people trying to get along and treating each other the way each one wants to be treated, and then we observe these two people over a week, what would you see? And you would see that at the beginning, let's say they both start, they're motivated, they want to prove that they can do this for a week. They're going to be so super aware and self-conscious and like make sure that they're living up to that. What happens in reality? And I tell you, from my own experience, it dawned on me. I have, you know, I drive and I get annoyed at drivers that I think are stupid. I hate to say it. Like, just like, come on, you're bad drivers. Like, you know, and then I realized, I'm like, okay, so I'm driving by. And for me in that moment, that guy is an idiot, right? He's not, he's in two lanes. But wait a second. We all have our moments. You know, maybe I'm more vigilant than most, and I'm going to be less of a, you know, inconsiderate idiot, you know, much of the time, but I've had my moments, whether I was tired, angry, confused, you know, distracted. We all have our moments. So now if you start, you know, quantifying that exponentially, adding in more than just two humans, but 8 billion humans, each one with a different psychology. We're like little, we all have, you know, levels of chemicals that are not stagnant. You wake up one day, it's a good day, then the bad day, the morning, this, you know, start off a good day, end up a bad day. There's just so much in the dynamic. Now, when we're at our best, of course, I, you know, treat others the way I want to be treated. Do I always do that? Absolutely not. So what ends up happening also is that it becomes easy to point it out in others and go, look, you see, that one's not doing it. That one's not doing it. But the reality is, if we really break it down, it starts with the self. We're really holding ourselves accountable to that. And it's a constant. There is no, you don't achieve it. You don't reach that goal and someone welcomes you and says, "Thank you. You're in the club now. You're good. You're just a wonderful human being."
3 minutes later.
Exactly. It's going to be challenged, and you got to be prepared for that challenge. And the point is to maximize the amount of time that you're acting in that way.
So I like this whole talk because you're kind of like you're jumping ahead for us. You know, we usually have to do a lot of explaining.
We have to explain this to everyone, but it sounds like you get it.
So here's the question. So it's very hard because it's going against our nature, which is interesting because, right, you'd expect that we would somehow evolve naturally into this, but no, somehow everybody sees that nature sort of stopped short of finishing that job, right? Almost as if nature or the creator, whatever you want to put up there at the top of the pyramid, you know, said, okay, the last bit to do. Yeah, you have to do it, right? It's up to you. You have to do it voluntarily, consciously. Otherwise, you'd just be an animal. And we don't need more animals. We need a human, right? Now, it's clear that there's a challenge. We're going against our nature. Even though it's in our nature to, right, like you care for your kids, right, for people who are close to you, when you're at your best, as you said, or sometimes when you're at your lowest, like, right, someone dies, God forbid, something happens, you feel it, right? You kind of become more sensitive. to the suffering of others, right? All that. But most of the time, we're kind of asleep and just automatically following our egoistic desires at the expense of everything and everyone. So the question that we want to ask is, how do we do it? It seems, and I'll let you answer, but it seems to us that you need a group, you need a collective to support us, right? Otherwise, by myself, doesn't matter how strong I am, it's not gonna. But if there's a group, right, and that's where the whole collectivity of the Jewish people,
even a small group that values it, it becomes so much easier to hold each other to it. Like if we're all fans of some football team or soccer team or something like that, it's and everyone's talking about it and in the WhatsApp group talking, even if I forget how great my team is, I wake up in the morning and I see the stats, I'm reminded,
right?
So,
and we're all taking our shirts off today in the game, right? Like it's all happy because we all decided. You feel like an idiot if you're not going to be part of the group, right? How do we do it? How do we create that for us? And we haven't even talked about the rest of the world yet, but
that is, the trillion-dollar question and something that, I don't think there's an answer. I think there is effort. What we know, what we're told, I don't think that in terms of approaching this and trying to, let's say, get this critical mass of people to actively be aware and try to apply this value in their lives, because, while we're hoping and praying and expecting and waiting for the end goal, the redemption, the day when there's no doubt about, the unity of creation and the oneness of the entire metaphysical structure. Okay, but the reality is, what it says in Pirkei Avot is, the work is great, right? There's a lot of work to do, but it's not on you to finish. Neither are you free to desist from it, but you cannot, it's not, so you have to keep it in proportion.
Right.
I for years I'd feel like this weight. I put this weight on my shoulders because you look around and you're like, you feel like you get it. You're like, what's so hard? I don't know. I just popped into the world a few years ago. There's thousands of years of history to examine. You examine it, you read through it, and you're like, oh, repetitive, 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 same stupid thing. We're going in cycles. What are we waiting for? A new technology is going to do what? They're going to put a chip in the brain, and that's going to make us realize. There's no greater knowledge that's going to bring world peace, and not a utopia, just, hey, how about states stop warring? Like, how do we not get that out of our system? And then we can work towards, religions and peoples and cultures not thinking they're supreme and not hating others. It's a matter of, we should never, just see the dark side. And it's like, because it could be overwhelming. There's a lot of it. There's so much hate there. Just if you try to quantify it, the ADL has a global survey that they do that they find that there are about 1 billion people worldwide that harbor anti-Jewish sentiments.
Yeah,
now,
I saw the numbers.
You understand why, because if there are 2 billion Christians and another billion and a half Muslims, and again, over thousands of years of 1,500, 2,000 years of indoctrination institutionalized where it was an article of faith. That's the difference. For Jews, there is no article of faith to hate any other group, to diminish their humanity, to demonize their soul. Nothing. It doesn't exist in our literature. Now, there are some controversial comments that could be taken out of context.
No, I agree.
The proof is in the pudding. What have Jews done in their 2,000 years?
So now you get into today, and it's good actually, because I want to do like a quick segue, because we're sprinting here, your book. So, one day you decide to write a book. What, this is not no small feat. What compels you to write a book about anti-Semitism of all topics? You can't change the world, right? You can't change a country. You can't change a city. You can't change a neighborhood. It's hard to get everyone in your building to agree on something, but you can change yourself. And that's what we're after. Little changes that will grow to a critical mass. What we're saying also is that we Jews, we've had it. There was a moment in time that Jews actually touched that quality that the whole world is waiting for us to give them, and which is what we're discussing in our talks. And you can hear about it in episode 7 of the Mystery Book Podcast, the first 22 episodes of this whole series. And we go into some amazing really heartwarming descriptions, right? Like the
Temple
Woodstock.
Love, that episode is called.
What's that? Temple Love, that right?
Episode, yeah, Temple Love.
Yeah, it was the Woodstock before Common Era.
Yeah, people should listen to that one and get a taste of something that they always knew should exist or had or could exist. It did exist. And that's what we're looking to build. Check that out in episode number 7, Temple Love.
This is the Jew Function, and let's get back to our guest. Your book. So, you know, one day you decide to write a book. What, you know, this is not no small feat. What compels you to write a book about anti-Semitism of all topics?
Yeah.
What's in it?
My background professionally was in, you know, design, marketing, communications, publishing. So, you know, I was coming from that background, and up until about 5-6 years ago, in the for-profit world, having a cushy life, but I was feeling unfulfilled, just like, okay, great. I felt like if I died at that point, which was like at the height of my, you know, professional career, I played it in my head. I'd be like, you know, forget about you believe in heaven or not. To me, it's not about that. To me, the moment of truth is, you know, even the moment right before death. I've had 2 near-death experiences. So the moment you feel like, oh, this is the end, be resolved to it. What happens in that moment? What really concerns you? And what I found was that when they say hell, the most hellish thing that I can imagine is when suddenly you are facing your entire life, all the truths about your life that you can no longer hide behind. And yet there is no possibility not to respond, not to hide, completely naked. And in that realization, realize how depressed one would be if they compare the life they lived to the truth they finally wake up to. So instead of, you know, and then I would say, okay, wait a second. So I live my life. Let's say I would die at that point, early 30s. Okay, what did I do with my life? Why was I here? Really? I came here to like work on for some brands and make some products and like raise Q3 and Q4 profits. Like, ooh, man, marvelous. What was I going to show? Like, hey, I gave you life, put you out, you know, gave you, you know, whatever I, you know, God endowed you with. I'm going to show my portfolio. I mean, it was clear to me that like that was not for me. I was not.
It's interesting. It's interesting that the human condition is such that almost dying is what brings us to have those things, and almost in a sense, like we all the time, Leo and I are constantly reflecting on this. Like it's these like moments where we get to the edge as a people that we kind of renew who we are and renew what we're doing. And we're trying to say like our premise is let's not wait until we almost die again. Let's try and talk to people now.
We've had enough near-death experiences.
We had so many good too, which, but by the way, any of them worth discussing here?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I can discuss both, but I agree with what you're saying, but it's like, that's the last resort, really. That's the end. That, you know,
but it's in order to come to, because here's the thing, you talked before about this golden rule. You could put a gun to someone's head and say, tell me you love me. You're like, okay, I love you. I love you. Now put the gun to someone's head and say, love me. He's like, how do you make somebody love? Now, when you're almost going to die and you have that reflection, then you, or like Leo was saying, when someone else, God forbid, passed away or something, and you're in those moments, you have some, oh, I understand. Well, wow. Like I need to focus my life on something meaningful. How can we help each other come to these moments? Because before that, it's really too hard. First of all, we have to not think we're going to convince the whole world at first, and we're not going to convince all of the Jews at first. So we have like a real small group to work with who kind of agree about this, or at least willing to talk about it. But even with those who agree, 3 minutes later, right, like you said earlier, like the golden calf. It's like, okay, we all come here. We agree we have to love each other. Leo mentioned before, if you're surrounded by an environment who always constantly making this important, so then that's one way to do it. But we have to, again, I'm coming back to it after that long-winded explanation there, that we don't want to come to almost dying again before we get this right. And we feel that it's a historic time and it is possible this time for us. Why weren't the other greats, you know, why wasn't Rabbi Akiva, King Solomon, all the rest of the great ones who were able to, you know, who came before us, who are way greater than us, able to do it, but why us? There's, I'm sure it's like a whole other conversation, but it does seem that the cards are on the table and there is a possibility that in our generation we can make something happen.
Well, so let's hear from yourself. So why did you write that book? What did you, what's well, in it? And I, what did you hope to get from it?
Based on what we just said, before I get into the anti-Semitism book, because on one hand, yeah, we shouldn't wait for those moments. Yet in Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, you know, he says that it's better to be in a house of mourning, right, than a house of celebration. I'm like, wait, why? Like celebration, the mitzvah, sudat mitzvah, like what could be better? And the answer is because, you know, you're closer to facing the truth. And that's constant. There's a reason why, you know, yeah, like you said, someone passes away close to you and then it hits you, right? Every time, because that mortality, the point is that, you know, don't believe in yourself until your day of death, it says, right? That's the only equalizer for us, because otherwise we can live in fantasy until it hits us when we expect it or not. So, you know, the realists, Jews need to be realists, ultimately. We have to be, you know, we're realists that believe, you know, and know that when we say miracle, it doesn't have to defy nature to be a miracle, and vice versa. It can be an explicit, you know, miracle, as it were. But that's God working through, you know, the world. The point is that, ironically, the first book I wrote was a reaction to those two near-death experiences. And it's called Who Will Remember You? A Philosophical Study and Theory of Memory and Will, where I basically, you know, arrived at a certain formula. What it showed me was that, you know, after I had those experiences, I'd have this like vision of like, okay, I'm hovering over my grave, and I'm like, who's there? You know, who would actually be there? What are they saying? And that's why I say I would start to think like, oh, what is there to say about me? What would I want people to say? Like, what do I want to work on that I, and oh, does it matter? You're dead anyway. Like, that's not the point. The point is that it happens to be such a, probably unconsciously, the most important motivator. And therefore I formulated, you know, you have the will to power, the will to pleasure, that, you know, going back to Nietzsche, to Epicurus, philosophers, about what is this that drives humans? They just want power. They want money. They want pleasure. They want, you know, I say that ultimately what people really want is, I call it the will to significance, which is underwritten by the will to memorability, which is that people simply want to feel significant. How do you do that? It's the other. And that's where it comes down to the golden rule, which is what's needed ultimately to, you know, redeem our existence. And that's particularly why it's needed, because all we want, and there are people who, that sense of the will to significance is warped, so they need adulation from millions, and it's still not enough. Most people just need, you know, one solid person, really. You can have three, you can have eight. But the solid person in your life that anchors you, that you go, you know, oh, I'm not floating here. Why am I here? I have no value. People want to have value. And how does the value determine? Memory, memorability. If you met someone, right? We're talking now, and then we bump in the street in 2 years, and, you know, I make like, I don't know you. It's like, that's like, I guess I wasn't significant to that person. Fine, right? It's a simple measure, you know? So, you know, saying that, these experiences for me happen to have come. The first one, I was in the army. I went to the Israeli army. I volunteered with my brother in 2002, the height of the Second Intifada. And I was stationed along the Lebanese border. And one day Hezbollah launched a rocket attack on our position. I happened to be in one of our base's posts. Anti-tank missile exploded nearby. You know, I wasn't actually within, you know, we were well protected enough, but something that like that hitting you close by their first time, like you're like, oh, someone's trying to like murder me right now at this moment. I mean, yeah, life flashes. What happens? You have like this flashback suddenly, like a bunch of, you know, moments that you kind of like recoiling into yourself. That was the experience for me. And that's why I left it like, wait. And then I said to myself, why did my neurology? Why does the brain decide that in the if this is going to be the last moment, let's do a quick recap? Why? Like what? And that's why I said to me, the hell is that? Because at that moment, that's what's left, you know, is the question of, well, what did I do? And at that time, you're also realizing I have no way to change the answer. And that could be extremely depressing if you're not ready for that moment. So, and that, of course, leads up to, you know, doing this book on anti-Semitism.
Wait, so what was the second one? Just for the curious listener there, what was the second
one? So the second one was later on. I mean, that I was 18, you know, actually, in like I said, it hit nearby. It was extremely scary. It's a lot louder than it is on TV and in the movies, you know. But the second was maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago, was with friends upstate New York in the mountain area on a highway. You know, four passengers in the car. I'm in the front passenger side and my friend's driving. And suddenly the car, we feel, starts swerving. And we're like, at first I look over to my friend. I'm like, Yaakov, like, stop messing. We're like, what are you doing? Like, I thought he's messing around. We're going 65, 70 miles an hour on the highway in the mountains, you know, two lanes this way, two lanes that way. And he's like, no, it's not me. And then, okay, we realized the back tire blew out. So the back of the car starts where you can imagine you're going 60, 70 miles an hour. You suddenly feel like, oh, I'm in a tuna can right now. Okay. The car started spinning 360 over, doing revolutions. Imagine if you're going and suddenly you're spinning and it's happening like in almost slow motion. And suddenly the person that was behind you, following you, you're now looking at them straight in the face like, oh, hello. And then you're spinning around. So at a certain point within doing those revolutions and we're spinning off into oncoming traffic, towards oncoming traffic, the median had just started like 50 yards earlier. In that moment, I was convinced in my mind, it was like, okay, this is it. Wow. There's no time to adjust. It's like, boom, it's on you. And you know, what that does to you is like, yeah, I could think about facing my death outside of such an experience. Nothing really drives it home. And it leaves you with a lot of those lessons of how precious life is, how not to take a single day, a moment for granted, not to take other people for granted. I lost my, you know, best friend, years ago, randomly like that. So all of that, of course, there is no better way. There's never going to be a better way. Obviously, the goal is that we shouldn't have to go to a funeral every day.
Isn't going to be a better way, but it's not the kind of experience we can package and give to each person on their bar mitzvah so that they know for the rest of their life to value life and how important it is to love one another and those kind of things.
For sure. But at some point, from the point of a childhood to adulthood, there is going to be there. I think for everyone, I can speak for myself only, but there is a certain point where mortality hits and brings a whole slew of lessons, you know.
But let's get back to your book in 1 second, but let's just say before that the entire country of Israel deals with these crises on a regular basis, and you can probably find more hatred in that country towards each other than anywhere else. So we would have to look at this,
which is why I want to get to your book finally. Wrote this brief history of anti-Semitism. Why'd you do it? You know, who needs it? Sorry for saying that this way. Why'd you do it? And I'm sorry. First of all, tell us in brief what's in it, and then tell us why did you write it? What did you hope to get out of this endeavor?
Sure. So when we started this organization, our startup, Upstart organization, Americans Against Anti-Semitism, was 2019. We noticed right away the uptick. It was 2018. You had the Pittsburgh Tree of Life synagogue shooting. I think it was March or April already by of 2019. You had the Poway synagogue in New York City. You had 3, 4, 5 times a day, sometimes knockout game, punch, hit, you know, all of that stuff. We noticed that the major orgs were tardy, late, lethargic, not responsive, not taking it seriously. So, you know, dove at the end of the day, but to correct what you had said at the beginning, was not a council member, New York State Assemblyman for 36 years, and he had just retired. And at the same time, because he was like the go-to person in the community, and this is where all the hate crimes are happening, the calls would still be coming in. They're turning to him, not to other people. So still dealing with that, we decided that there was a need to, you know, create this organization so that whatever activities we undertake, you know, with this goal, we can do it properly. And the goal was recognizing that we need to study anti-Semitism, that you can't just, oh, you think you know it, you've read a book and you figured out and like, okay, this is this type of hate, there's right wing, left wing, it is how we fight it. You know, it doesn't really work like that. In reality, again, what we found, we're going out there, we start, the easiest thing is to at least talk on social media. You see something, you say something. So that's the minimum. You can't let things slide. Now, you can't also make a big deal about everything because you can end up amplifying, but we'll leave that aside. At the same time, we went out there and said, okay, we're studying anti-Semitism. What's needed? What's going to make a difference? Not because a lot of organizations like, oh, let's put up a billboard in Times Square. Okay, you know, oh, it might be cute. It might have a nice little message about anti-Semitism. Who's it to convince? Like the anti-Semite, they're going to get convinced. The supporters, they'll be like, oh, yeah, I really support the Jews. The Jews, they'll be like, oh, yeah, it's pretty messed up. Like, what's the point? You know, it's nice. Don't get me wrong. Bravo, you know, and people feel good about it. But it was that type of stuff. They were like, this is not what we're about. We're not looking to duplicate efforts. So we start operating. And by the end of the year, 2019, the end of the year, you had an attack on the Muncie, kosher grocery, the Hanukkah attack on in the synagogue. Dove went and gave a speech to, you know, yeshiva, modern Orthodox yeshiva kids, teenagers, older teenagers, and they have a background, they have the education, they've learned the Holocaust, Zionism, all of that stuff. But he was surprised at how much information and you know, specifically about anti-Semitism that they were lacking and that they didn't have. And this, so a light went off. It was like, wait a second. If this is the educated set, you know, that should, you know, have enough to work with, then we got a problem. So to me, right away, what it said is, you know, this thing of like trying to convince anti-Semites is pointless. There's no, you don't go and endeavor to do that. Can it happen that you'll find a real anti-Semite and through, you know, dialogue, this will somehow convert and come back? Yeah, it can happen. But you wouldn't endeavor because it's like barking up the wrong tree. I mean, it's just futile. So what was important, what we identified was not only that people just need to be educated, but especially when it comes to who's on the front lines of anti-Semitism. When we say hate crimes in New York City, 90% of the victims are Orthodox Jews. They're on the front. But generally, when we say, you know, as an American, as a Jew, I go online, I experience anti-Semitism, that's not the same front lines as Jewish students who are thrust onto campus, you know, university campuses, because that's where, you know, it all converges. You have the space to do it. You have state-sponsored organizations that are fueling anti-Jewish animus. They're on the front lines. Oh, okay. Well, the approach has been, especially, you know, in the whole anti-Zionism, let's create the Hasbarites, let's debate, you know. The goal of this was not to create a bunch of debaters and, you know, because that suggests that they would even, that there's legitimacy to it. You need to debate. No, the point was not to learn this stuff so that you can, which you can, obviously, if someone, and if it's a legitimate debate and someone really wants to know, then, you know, arm yourself with the right information and do it. But the point was different. The point was, you know, to strengthen, you know, Jews internally, so that you can know your history, so that it can be distorted by others, so that your identity, your pride, your confidence in, you know, something like the IDF, this notion that, well, do they kill babies? Okay, you know, look at the history. The fact that idea that Jews kill babies is actually not 100 years old, not 200, not 500, more than 2000. So that was the goal. The goal was to say, the way I treated this and the way I see anti-Semitism is exactly like a virus. There's no better metaphor, none, because it operates, it functions, it has the same characteristics. And the way to understand it is the same as you would when you're looking at a virus. You have to understand its pathology. Where did it come from? You know,
hold on. This is an important point. And I want to press on that because, so you create this book, sort of a timeline, visual timeline, I guess, highlighting all those things you said. Great. And you also come to identify anti-Semitism as a virus. If I take that analogy and I extend it, viruses work in the body, or you could say attack the body or work in the body, however you want to see it. when the body is out of balance. That's usually what happens.
Yeah.
So my question is, how do you bring the body into balance? You can't possibly, we already agreed, you said it, you can't debate all the anti-Semites, you can't change their minds. The information is out there. If they want to be learned and educated, they can. It's clearly not about that. It's something that we're not doing. And that's, again, our whole premise is we're only 50 million of us. Even if I fought the whole world, there's no chance. We can't go head to head with 9 billion people. What we do have is a group that's sort of cohesive, especially when there's pressure from the outside, we become more cohesive. Also, we happen to have people in some key positions that can help move things along. How do we use that? What needs to happen within that body, let's call it, in order for this virus of anti-Semitism to go away? That's really the trillion-dollar question that we said at the beginning. We kind of connected it to love, the other, and all that, but really, what are you teaching you and the Americans against anti-Semitism? What are you really asking people to do?
So the premise that anything we can do, or that the goal is to make anti-Semitism go away, I think it's problematic, leaving aside philosophically if we can ever get there. It's like, it's the big question. If there'll be a redemption, there'll be a Messiah, there'll be, like, obviously it's incompatible with, a messed up world.
It says the salvation of the Lord is as the blink of an eye. So let's leave that to him, okay?
Right. So leaving that aside, right? Jews, you could pray for miracles. You can't rely on them. Yaakov met his brother Esav. He prepared for war and prayed for peace. You have to do both. Now, the preparations is not for peace. You pray for peace. You can hope for it. The preparations, what you actually do, have to be practical, tangible, and attached to reality. So the way I see it is not a question of, like, how are we going to eliminate this virus? You don't eliminate viruses. You mitigate against their, worst effects. That's the best you can do. Again, the approach is almost Hippocratic. Sur mera vaseh tov. Don't do any harm. Number one is, like, to lower the temperature. Where there's two sides to it. And there's the proactive, we can go and, intercommunal, interfaith.
You said, hold on, Israel, you said at the beginning something like a person who is, I don't remember exactly what you said, but the child who is loved and cared for and raised in a good family isn't usually the one who goes out and, I don't remember what you said, commits a crime or something like that, right? There's something to that in an environment of love and care, that environment does not harbor this hatred. If people felt that what's radiating out of us as a people is support and love and a stable world where their children are going to be safe, then why would they hate us? On the other hand, if people feel empty and despaired, and they're looking for a place to point the finger, there's no better place than at us. I don't think anyone else is doing what we're doing. And and that's exactly it. No, nobody can comprehend what we're talking about. Who would even say that anti-Semites have anything valuable to say without saying we're anti-Semitic or we're self-hating Jews? But there's something that everybody's missing in this whole picture. And the reason why the solution is so close is because we're not waiting for anyone else to change. We're not waiting for the laws to be enacted. We're not waiting for a new politician to get elected. The answer is way closer than everybody thinks.
Like us, hit the bell thing on the YouTube so you can get a notification when a new episode is up. Well, this is the Jew Function, and let's get back to our guest.
If people felt that what's radiating out of us as a people is support and love and a stable world where their children are going to be safe, then why would they hate us?
We were told that we're being hypocritical. We should kind of bring this light to people, but we say one thing with this hand and then we do something else with this hand. When we say, hey, let's build something, average Jews are great, are loving, whatever, but then you have Jews in positions of power and they bring terrible things into this world, on the left and on the right, in entertainment.
Is there a take-home message in the book?
So of course, there are, in, well, the take-home message is not even necessarily, okay, so you read the history, now go combat it and, you know, do what you got to do.
Make
and
this history.
And this is how it's going to work. And this is how the only way to be successful. That is like, I think it's beyond the scope of any book or what anyone, or even what's needed. The real point, and some people have asked, they go, okay, you have a collection here really of what could be looked at as a collection of dark moments and chapters of history that are just not easy to absorb. Like, how do you, you know, keep reading about, now again, it's not all just, you know, murder, this and that. And I don't just put, there's nothing in here that is like, oh, here's another story and just have another story. And this is a gruesome and let me just, so it's, you know, interesting details. No, there had to have been a point in each story that you're drawing out something again about the pathology or the virology of the given mutation. So you had Christian European mutation, you had the Islamist mutation, you had the Islamic Muslim religious mutation that was earlier. So to me, it's not even about like become an expert, know how to respond. The whole point of this, my feeling in going through this was twofold. Obviously, it weighed, it was heavy. The amount of tears that went down in the process of making, the process of going through the archives. You have to sit there and read these stories and everything that didn't make it into this book that, you know, I had to filter out. Yes, on the one hand, I was like, good Lord, man, does it ever end? Like what? Like, how, and how does, like, how are we still here? How does nobody look at it and be like, you know, I think we've been pretty nasty to the Jews for 2000 years. We should probably like lighten up. Oh, murder against Jews because, you know, we love them to death because they didn't accept our loving God. You know, enough is enough. At the same time, the flip side of all those dark chapters is that we persisted, we continued, we flourished, we rebuilt. And to me, the power that left me after, you know, the heaviness was far stronger. And that's what I want to leave people with. The goal is to build confidence in the knowledge of a Jew's history and pride in it.
But what's the, but this is all great. And this is kind of like, it's a great setup, but I feel like things in nature have a purpose. I don't think the purpose is to, oh, you know, eternal suffering by anti-Semites so you can persist and persevere as a Jew. No. And this is where I turn to the Jewish text, who say clearly, you know, calamity comes to the world because of Israel. Israel has to be rebuilt, and then the world will be rebuilt. You know all those quotes better than me. And also the network science that showed us that the hubs in the network have to work a certain way or the network collapses. I put these two things together, and then also you say anti-Semitism is a virus, so how do we create an environment that will be antiviral, right? Like you wash your hands and you have to do certain things and keep yourself healthy. I want to, you know, what is that? And to us, in our research, the answer was very clear. Jews have to create a healthy environment among all Jews because we all kind of carry that load equally. The guy who founded Facebook and the guy who goes to shul, they all have a part in it. Because for whatever reason, we were like, you know, descendants of that group, which was made, pulled together from the representatives of all, you know, from all the nations in the world to carry that quality for some reason. Again, whatever reason it is. But we're not doing it. So you put all this beautiful history together. You said we have all these trials and tribulations, but the environment that is antiviral is one of love and unity, and we are not doing it. Us Jews are not creating that healthy environment. So the question is, how can we move away from all these imaginary dealings? How can I get the guy who is mostly thinking about, you know, his next car or making it here or going into politics and all those other ideas people have in their heads, and putting it all towards unity? That's really what it comes down to for us.
So I agree that ultimately, you know, ideally we want golden rule for everyone and we'd love to promote it, you know, to the world. But I 100% agree that, you know, if it can come to that the world somehow evolved to that level and Jews still didn't.
No, you can't. The world cannot. That's my point.
Right. It just doesn't make sense. Now, again, that's why I say Jews need to do what they need to do. Because let's assume, okay, well, Jews, as if that's going to help. So let's say all the Jews get along and then, well, the rest of the world, it doesn't change. All right, we'll worry about that when we get there. I'm pretty confident. Are you that?
No, impossible. That yeah. Like again, you said, from Pirkei Avot, it's because he's going to finish the job. it's not required for us to finish the job. We didn't have to make the universe. We didn't have to make, you know, form human beings. All we have to do is put ourselves together in the right way. And our premise is that he fills it with life, you know, man, woman, and then the creator Shekhinah. Between them, the Shekhinah between them. It's like you can bring a two flesh together, two pieces of flesh together. But if you want to fill it with a soul, you need some other force. Nobody, you don't go to the grocery store and get a soul or to Dolce right. & Gabbana. You need a source that you can't buy. You need that extra source. So it's, we don't need to figure out exactly how it's going to all work. We just, it's just upon us.
The effort, as you said, the
to
effort.
Do that effort, like you said, well, that you brought up in Pirkei
Avot. We're not doing it. They just announced that the next James Bond is going to be Jewish. That's the excitement of the Jewish.
Finally.
Yeah, he's just That's coming out. Yeah, his name
oh
is.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Aaron Taylor Bye. Johnson, whatever. My point is, I feel, and I'm saying, I'm not asking you for an answer. It's more like, you know, if there is a power listening in, I really want to know, how can we turn our attention back onto being the ministers of this peace and unity, the priests, the Kohanim and Levim of the whole world on the path to wholeness, to peace. The world is not going to drop it. It's not going to do it. You know, we have to do it.
The golden rule requires healthy thinking. It's a healthy cycle. You give, you get. No, don't be righteous. No, I only give. That's BS. It doesn't end up working. Now, give without the expectation of receiving. But naturally, if things are healthy, it'll go round and round. So when you see a warping in individuals, in certain cultures, you know, writ large, that have this attitude still today, where they're waiting. I don't know, each one is waiting to be reclaimed their, you know, their empire status, or oh, one day we're going to get it. We're like, really? There are still cultures, you know, there's Russia, Germany, this one. And in each one, they're convinced that you're the greatest. Like, really? Come on. You can't look around and be like, there's great stuff that came out of Germany, out of France, out of England, out of Timbuktu. So what? So that, to me, what can we do? And what can actually change? And it's practical. It's not lofty. It's like, now, how can we reach 8 billion people? How do you reach the critical mass? So to me, we're going back to how we started. It's a critical mass that has a very simple commitment to this idea, which would not mean that it's automatic perfection. Everyone who has this idea, right, it will just be rolling. But like a virus, you said, right? The antidote to a virus, it works and spreads in the same way. You build up immunities in the same way by inoculation. How do you inoculate? So with hate, it's against ignorance.
Okay, so just to make it easy for everyone who's listening, we're not going to deal with 116 million at first, although we'll be happy you get Israel's book, come listen to the podcast. But we're really interested in finding that small group of people at first who hears this message, who feels that unity is the place to go, that after looking at everything else in your life, that unity between us is the place to go. And from there, we create some field around us of love and connection. It brings in more people and other layers and other layers and other layers. I'd like to read a little quote here, to kind of, hopefully this one, I just found this one, I'll summarize it up. We're not talking about us, but in general, like Jonah, we're sound asleep. Though we're beginning to wake up to the existence of hatred towards us, we have yet to realize that not carrying out our mission, just like Jonah, is the reason for the hatred. If we don't wake up soon, the sailors will throw us overboard as they did with Jonah. In the words of Rav Yehuda Ashlag, the author of the Sulam commentary on the Book of Zohar, it's incumbent upon the Israeli nation to qualify itself and the rest of the people in the world to evolve into assuming the sublime work of love of others.
Amen. Thumbs it up. Now we just need to do the work.
Nice. Isael, nice. Wow.
It comes down person to person, ultimately. To me, every interaction is an opportunity to prove to the world that you're not a jackass. So, you know, one thing I want that you asked earlier, and I'll be done, you know, all talking with this. And you also wanted some reading something from the book, and right, that I think encapsulates the message perfectly, is the dedication, which includes a little paragraph that I put, plus a quote from Maimonides that I'll quickly read, and I'll be done with that. So I wrote that this work is dedicated to our cherished 6 million, to all the victims of anti-Jewish terrorism, and to every Jew throughout history who was cursed, tormented, beaten, tortured, butchered, burned at the stake, forced to convert, expelled from their country, marginalized in society, and made to live in constant fear on account of being Jewish. It is due to an astonishing faith and unparalleled perseverance that there exists an unbroken Jewish chain of transgenerational transmission we can all take immense pride in and draw endless strength from. Their memory is an eternal blessing. And quote from Maimonides, "Our nation speaks with pride of the virulent oppression it has suffered and the sore tribulations it has endured. To quote the words of the Psalmist 44:23, nay, but for thy sake are we slain all day long," end quote. The rabbis of blessed memory in Midrash Hazita remark that the verse, "nay, but for thy sake," alludes to the generation that undergoes persecution. Let those persons exult who suffered dire misfortunes, were deprived of their riches, forced into exile, and lost their belongings. It behooves the victim, for the sake of his religion, to escape and flee to the desert and wilderness, and not to consider separation from family or loss of wealth. For they are a slight sacrifice and a paltry offering due to God, King of kings, possessor of all things, the Lord thy God, whose name is glorious and awesome. God may be trusted to compensate you well in this world and in the world to come. So to me, the Rambam understood it. He got it, obviously. Didn't need me to say that. But that's why that was at the beginning of the book, because, you know, the other part is that we're not ultimately in control. We have to accept the reality and accept the limits of our ability to operate and do it and do our part, and not also cry over, we know it's difficult. Like, the bottom line is we need to do what we need to do, and we'll get to where we're getting to. The only question is how long it'll take.
Exactly. Well, this was the Unstoppable Yisrael Biton, 100 miles an hour. But thank you so much for coming here to talk to us, man. This was, we could probably talk for hours more. It seems like you have an endless fountain. So maybe we'll have another chat. I hope you don't mind.
We can keep, you know, the dialogue online, offline. It's important to, you know, share these ideas.
We're just starting. This is what we think the Jew function is all about, to, you know, open up those pipes, let this good feeling flow between us. That's how it starts. So this is the Jew function. Thank you for listening. Like, share, comment, subscribe, all those great things. You'll find all the information about Yisrael's book in the description, and we'll see you here next time. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.